large donations from special interests are absolutely buying access, and I view it as corruption. The private campaign finance system right now is knowingly and directly responsible for the systemic corruption of public policymaking. And that's in both parties, especially, but we're interested in advancing independent accountability in the Democratic Party to have the best possible policy outcomes.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight.
David Moore is co-founder of a new investigative journalism startup called Sludge, which is focused on money and politics and related matters with a distinct point of view in their progressive digital muckraking. Sludge has an interesting history as a newsroom on Civil, a blockchain-based publishing platform for ad-free and independent journalism. David formerly worked on Open Congress, which was a popular nonprofit site for tracking bills and money in the U.S. Congress. I was curious about Sludge, its politics, and the business model for such an enterprise. David and I discussed all that and more. It was a good conversation. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with David Moore at Sludge.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, David.
Hi, Nathaniel.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure thing. Thanks very much for this opportunity. So I'm David Moore, and I'm a co-founder with Sludge. Sludge is at readsludge.com, and we're an independent newsroom on money and politics. So we're an investigative journalism outlet, and I'm excited to share a little bit more about the kind of muckraking we do.
It's funny. I was thinking about the reading that I did as a kid of, you know, like Lincoln Steffens and Upton Sinclair and Ida Tarbell and people like that. Uh-huh. And I was wondering if you were going to reference the muckrakers. That's how you see yourself?
We think of ourselves as sort of contemporary digital muckrakers. Our journalism uses a few different methods, but some of the muckrakings could have been associated with on-the-ground investigations. A lot of our work is with public records that are already available. And there's an old money and politics reporter cliche, which is that the scandal isn't something illegal that's happening. The scandal is what's legal, typically. And we're seeing that play out today in government at a bunch of different levels. Sludge is about 18 months old, an independent newsroom project. We're supported by our members. I co-founded it with our co-founder, Donald Shaw, who's based up in Massachusetts. And Danny and I previously had worked together on a project called opencongress.org. And that was from 2007 to 2013. Where we developed that project for congressional transparency on bills and votes and money in the U.S. Congress. And we were joined by Alex Koch, who's our senior reporter, who came from over from doing a lot of investigative work with TYT Investigates and Facing South, and then most recently as part of the International Business Times. And we've been fortunate to work with a couple of other journalists in starting up the project. Most recently, we've got some great partnerships in co-publishing that helps our articles reach the outlets such as The American Prospect and Truthout. And we're part of a project this week called Covering Climate Now. And I can talk a little bit more about the way that we approach money and politics and the kind of analysis that goes into a typical Sludge story as we focus on the ways in which industries and special interests advance their agendas.
Why did you name it Sludge?
That goes back a bit to the muckraking. So we were interested in conveying a bit of the system and the network that results in the kind of politics that we have now. And a lot of this project really does come out of our experience with Open Congress, covering Congress every day for 7 years. And this was primarily during the Obama administration. and discovering over and over again that popular legislation was not advancing to hearings and certainly not advancing into being passed by a chamber or advancing for a signature to the president. And this is, of course, because of, you know, not just because of the partisan gridlock in Congress, but because of the special interest gridlocks in Congress. I can chat for a minute about the history of the different legislative initiatives in the Obama administration and why they didn't advance. And then exposing that work and especially the lobbying and revolving door culture of DC and state governments was our interest with Sledge. And we wanted to bring our particular kind of analysis and looking at not just the public records that are available, like, you know, the campaign contribution data that you find on a website like opensecrets.org, but also looking into the lobbying records and AstroTurf groups to try to put together a deeper analysis of the swamp and a deeper analysis of the kind of conflicts of interest and the hidden influence that results in responsive and effective and productive policies not being implemented.
The sludge is kind of what is at the bottom of the swamp.
We see the sludge in the news, in the headlines every day. There's, of course, the top line sludge is what the Times and the Post are fantastically following in the Trump administration's corruption and the refusal of the Republican-controlled Senate to investigate. And that plays out, of course, on cable news every day. We're then seeing lots and lots more examples of the swamp and the sludginess of it in action around things like the debate now in the Democratic primary around the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, free public college. And we've long seen it around issues that are really important to different kinds of communities, not just progressives, but lots of different kinds of communities, like community broadband and the influence of the major telecom companies on walking back net neutrality and on preventing strong community broadband initiatives from happening. That's a great case study of the kind of what we call systemic corruption of the legislative and policymaking process.
Does that mean that you think that anyone holding views that differ from the progressive left must be therefore corrupt?
No, I wouldn't say that. The issue of community broadband offers a real clear case, I think. And, you know, we're not the only folks who have been able to point this out. We, for a long time in our work on open source and transparency, we were influenced by people like Professor Susan Crawford, whose analysis of the telco industry has been really influential for me over the years, and lots of other academics and expert groups that have looked at community broadband as a real clear case of people with different, you know, self-identified political positions or different priors, all being blocked by the influence of these monopolistic telcos. So community broadband isn't just favored by progressive activists who are interested oftentimes in getting a message out that's more progressive than what some of the major corporate-owned media channels tend to disseminate on their airtime. It's also a crucial issue for community resiliency and for rural Americans' access to information for growing economies. Community broadband is a clear case where the established players preventing state governments from advancing wider access and more state-level net neutrality initiatives is a clear case of capture and control. And in her latest book, Professor Susan Crawford documents how state-level telco lobbyists would literally hand over the template for the bills to the legislators who dominated the chamber, oftentimes Republicans. And that's not unheard of across a lot of different issue areas, from the healthcare industry to even from, you know, defense contractors and weapons makers and more. The legislative text, the bills that gets handed down from groups like ALEC and others, oftentimes goes right into the hands of the party that controls a legislative chamber, and then it goes right to the floor vote where it's rushed through without a lot of availability for public input. So our goal is always to open up this information to wide public input and wide public scrutiny, open access, open information, and trying to liberate government data through the channels that do exist now to make it more actionable, to make it easier for a busy person to watchdog, and to make it easier for the experts who do have the time and the bandwidth incentives to track issues, to be able to flag them for their community, to identify what the key points are in the legislative process and where the effective channels of intervention are. Documenting that openly on a free website like Sledge, we view that as, you know, part of our strong public accountability mission. And it's we're not doing it just within the email group of a particular party or of a local activist chapter. We're doing it on the public internet, and that's the kind of information we think is going to result in better outcomes on all of these important policy areas that'll advance initiatives that we care about, like the Green New Deal and net neutrality.
It does seem like a good mission. When just looking at where you came from, it's fascinating to see that you're a project of a foundation that has open source software for independent news orgs. Can you talk a little bit about sort of that structure and how you fit in as a startup in that space?
So Sludge is, we're our own project. So Sludge is like a public benefit corporation newsroom startup. We received our startup grant from the Civil Foundation, and Civil is a media company that was making a new publishing platform for independent journalism. And Civil provided us with the startup funds, as well as a bunch of other great newsroom projects as well. But since that startup grant ended, Sludge has been fundraising and crowdfunding on our own, as well as publishing in partnerships with other political news outlets, so publishing investigative projects. And so we are 100% member-supported independent newsroom. We do care a lot about, like I mentioned, open access to information. And so our site is on, the listeners might be familiar with the model of the Guardian US. There's no paywall, but there is a membership pitch and a donor appeal. And so we have a couple of those on our site. And a really important way that we converse with our readers is through our weekly newsletter, where we send out our top articles and money and politics links from around the web. So that newsletter is free. You can sign up in the middle of our homepage as well. And another area that how we interact with our readers and interact with other journalists is, of course, we spend all day on Twitter, of course, and as well we keep up outposts and a few other social media channels. Prior to founding Sludge, our website Open Congress was a project of my 501c3 nonprofit organization, the Participatory Politics Foundation, which also built a few other web tools for civic engagement and public dialogue. We found that there is a huge opportunity to increase public knowledge and civic engagement around the influence of special interests over the policymaking process and help people understand why really beneficial and popular policies like community broadband aren't being implemented. Why do you only have one internet service provider where do you live? Or, you know, why don't you have an electric vehicle infrastructure in your city? Or why are your healthcare premiums so expensive? Or why is it so difficult to obtain information about the companies that provide weapons and equipment to your local police organizations? We think that there's the lobbying especially offers the key to understanding the flow of money and the political structures that exist now. And if you can understand lobbying and the revolving door as being the really key issues to highlight in news analysis, then a lot of other news stories can snap into place.
So does Civil Foundation launch other sort of groups like yours?
Civil provided the startup funding for a number of other publications, and those grants have all run their course. But there's great projects, including the cultural website Popula, the great immigration news site in New York State called Documented, and our colleagues at the project called Cannabis Wire that documents the cannabis industry, and lots more. I could go on. They created a publishing platform that integrates with the Ethereum blockchain. And so that then in the future will enable different kinds of distributed publishing and decentralized publishing options on the Ethereum platform, which is, you know, one of the major public blockchains.
How are you doing as an enterprise? Like, are you able to fundraise enough to cover your overhead and, I don't know, add on reporters?
Well, we're a three-person team, and fundraising is a major part of my focus. Our senior reporter, Alex, produces hard-hitting investigations regularly, and Donnie, who's, you know, has extensive experience in campaign finance reporting, and he just put out a fantastic article with the Accountability Project Little Sis on the private equity firms at hedge funds and campaign contributions. We're always appealing to our members to support our investigations. We have a crowdfunder up that if we're at this point in the conversation now, I'll just mention that I put up a project that lives on the banner of our website right now, although maybe when folks listen, it'll be different, but it's to investigate the 359 plus DNC members who set the rules for the Democratic Party and to produce the first ever comprehensive report on them. And back in March, we ran a successful Kickstarter campaign for a climate desk. And this climate desk in turn enabled our reader-supported investigations into the fossil fuel industry's influence over climate policy. And then most recently, just yesterday was a phenomenal day of publishing for our team. I was really excited to that Sledge had a story on the front page of the Guardian US for most of the day yesterday that analyzed US senators' financial holdings and conflicts of interest. And a lot of that included in the energy sector, included companies in the oil and gas industry. So that was a fantastic article that was reported by Alex Koch and got a lot of sort of reshares as part of the Covering Climate Now week. And we're really grateful for that awesome partnership with The Guardian.
That is kind of amazing for an independent three-person team to be placing it in a big organ like that. Do they compensate you for that? Is that part of, or is that just, hey, we're happy to get as many eyeballs on our work as possible?
Those deals are always a little different depending on what you're pitching and what's produced. Those stories are all helpful to bring in a little bit through the door, but they're not enough to, you know, pay a reporter a full-time salary to live. So we count on our members to help us support that. And our members sign up for $5 and $9 a month and receive things like Sledge t-shirts. We had Sledge coffee mugs last year, and those are all picked up.
I'd be a little worried about Sledge at the bottom of the coffee mug, but
that was part of the gag. That was part of the bit. For example, for this Guardian piece, we were able to bring a unique data set on conflicts of interest in Congress, because not many people know that members of Congress are actually allowed to own stocks in industries that they regulate. And so you can be on the Energy Committee and own stock in a coal company, and Senator Manchin does. We were able to take that information out of the PDFs where it's disclosed and put it into a spreadsheet so it becomes machine-readable data. And then we can compile it and analyze it to be able to produce totals for how many senators own Amazon stock, or how many senators own stock in private prison or Lockheed Martin, and produce reports following up from that. That's a really important angle for Sledge as we analyze the legislative process and the policymaking process, because, you know, one rule of thumb in influence reporting and in corruption reporting is that the key choke points in the legislative process are the committee chairs. Since I use the example of community broadband, in your state legislature or in the U.S. Congress committee, it's a committee chair who's in the position of seniority and authority to be able to determine whether an amendment to support, you know, greater access to affordable broadband would advance. And oftentimes, they are the office that's ultimately responsible for not including an amendment in the vehicle that will be, you know, voted on, or shunting off an amendment to be voted down through some other process or as part of some other bill that's doomed in the full chamber. So looking at their networks of money, which is, you know, not just their direct campaign contributions from telco companies like AT&T, but also their lobbying expenses and how many of their employees have gone through the revolving door. Experts in corruption and in campaign finance journalism point to that as the key beat. We do a lot of play in that field. That's really core Sledge, if I may. And surfacing those connections is part of the big money in politics story. It's, you know, it's not always cash in a paper bag in a parking garage or buying rooms at the hotels of the golf resort owned by key decision maker. A lot of the time it's, you know, knowing that you're doing your 2 years in government so that you can cash out and make $360,000 as a VP at a government affairs firm for working for Verizon or Comcast or AT&T.
How many members are you up to, and how many do you think you need to be like at the size that you'd like to be?
I'm going to punt on disclosing the number of members that we have, but it's good.
You're not going to be transparent the way you're wanting.
Well, we're right now not disclosing our total number of members because we're still looking for support from a variety of channels. We're interested in foundation grants for public accountability work. We're interested in major donors who want to support projects like our accountability project at the DNC. And we're interested then in partnerships with other investigative newsrooms and that are interested in the fossil fuel industry. So right now we haven't put that number out there. For the listeners, I'll be reachable and I'm online all the time. So we'll see if I'm able to put up a follow-up post or a note on that, Nathaniel. But there's also a great movement towards, like, you know, newsletter distribution on Patreon and Substack. And so they can compare us to other projects that are posted there, whether you're looking at the great work of the team from Data for Progress or the People's Policy Project or others.
Let's say I were interested in funding you. either as a member or in some other way, because it seems like you're doing good work. I mean, I would probably want to know things like, are you up to 500 members or are you up to 50,000? Am I needed? I'm hoping that there's people listening that could get a sense of, is that something that you would share more directly with the potential large funder? Who would be a legit large funder for you? Obviously, you're not going to take money from ExxonMobil to do investigation.
That's right. So I appreciate this opening to share. I will say that we are urgently seeking more members to support us. Yes, in answer to your question, in discussions with major donors who support accountability or support money in politics research, yes, those numbers get shared. Your current growth trajectory, your rate based on your current reach across different sorts of channels or platforms. So yeah, those numbers do get shared in funding discussions. And one really great opportunity with Sludge is that we are on a path to being independently self-sustainable, but we do need more people to sign up. So joining and being a $5 a month member to support our kind of investigative journalism, I can describe, you know, at length about how our focus on money and politics is producing original investigations that we hope are really benefiting the news landscape, and how we have, everyone says they punch above their weight, so to speak, but we're able to get stories in our reporting is, you know, was on the Guardian homepage yesterday. And that's the kind of impact that we want to replicate throughout 2020 as we do more coverage of the environment and the healthcare industry and more.
Can you help me understand how you intersect with sort of partisan politics? It seems like what you're saying is pretty avowedly nonpartisan. Like, you're going to investigate DNC leaders, you're going to investigate Congress members without regard to party. But there might be a lot of people who feel like right now the big problem in the country is the Republican Party, and their ties to industry are far more extensive and blatant. You know, the way that they're working in state legislatures, much more supportive of industries there, as you've sort of hinted at. So, you know, how do you deal with that intersection between partisanship?
For that, I can disclose some bits of personal history, which I'm happy to share, which is that, so from 2002 to 2004, when I was relatively fresh out of college, I worked on Democratic campaigns as a field manager. I did voter targeting for ACT Ohio in 2004. So that was the key battleground state in the 2004 presidential election. ACT Ohio was the 527 organization, of course, seeking to register voters and do Democratic-based turnout as well. And then after the 2004 shortcoming, about which I have more to sort of say in a personal manner, I returned to Ohio in 2006 to serve as the GOTV director for the Ohio Democratic Party. So I've definitely worked in field and campaigns, a lot of canvassing and a lot of voter targeting. The sort of epiphany moment that happened to me was that in 2006, when we were looking to produce some candidate slates that were down to the local ballot, and we didn't have the funding for it in the party to be able to produce these walk cards, I was able to sort of string together a number of calls to understand how funding to the state parties came to and from the national parties and from the DN, the DS, and the DTrip. And when you put together that knowledge and the landscape of how the money flows between them, and they're not all, you know, always necessarily just on their own budget, but that there is extensive agreements between them, depending on which one of them are up and who's down and which, you know, who's in cycle and where the big money is flowing. So then in 2016, when it was revealed after, you know, in the Democratic primary in April, May, June, and July, the fund sharing agreement between the Hillary Clinton for president campaign and the DNC, and how state parties in turn were keeping less than 1% of the money they were raised while it was being flowing back up to the national party. You know, I was surprised by the revelations, but not totally surprised that money was flowing in these ways without a lot of transparency and accountability. And these are stories that I think it's really important to tell in order to have the sort of the buy-in of progressives and disaffected non-voters who will want to know that the Democratic Party is going to be accountable to them and not just the corporate elites and the lobbyist donors. I think there's lots of studies about the positive impacts of trust and participation in the democratic process that comes through transparency and sort of demonstrating real feedback mechanisms that have some purchase, where there's some effectiveness in the party. And if in 2020, a few more percentage points of, left-leaning and Democratic voters feel energized by the prospect of a more open party, then I think the benefits for the country will be immense.
So can I translate that to understanding your politics, that you came from Democratic roots, but you're very dubious of the establishment of the Democratic Party and the current mechanisms by which fundraising and favors and so on get exchanged?
That's a fair description. A lot of this has been documented in the phenomenal recent book, We've Got People, by Ryan Grimm, the journalist of The Intercept, whose work has long been influential. And he was covering Congress at the Huffington Post while we were covering Congress on Open Congress. So got long readership there. The Democratic leadership of the House and Senate, I would describe myself as part of the progressive Twitter critique of their strategy around everything from impeachment to accepting law. And then everything around, certainly around the impeachment inquiries and around other sorts of marketing and youth voter outreach and outreach to communities of color that I think are so vital to the success of a progressive agenda. And then professionally, because we analyze campaign contributions and we report on campaign finance, we've reported extensively on how the DN, the DS, and the DTRIP have taken lobbyist donations from fossil fuel industry, from for-profit healthcare industry, and even from private prison companies in some cases as well, and some of the tech monopolies. In the case of the fossil fuel industry, we report on the DNC's contributions quite extensively because we think it's so important for the Green New Deal framework to be raised for independent consideration in the party. And right now it's being blocked by Speaker Pelosi's leadership and one of her chief aides, Wendell Primus, and as well as the House Democratic leadership of the DTRIP, including Representative Sherry Bustos, continues to take in healthcare lobbyist donations as they seek to influence the outcome of primaries in states, like the Colorado Senate is the most recent example in their endorsement of Hickenlooper. So on the Sledge site, clicking on any of the top options for 2020 or influence will take you to some reports where we cite the numbers and link to the reports and interview experts around what the influence of all this lobbyist money does to the priorities at the DNC and the boundaries of what's legislatively possible.
There's often a difference in point of view about a contribution between, say, a journalist in general and a political scientist, where a lot of journalists might view it that a contribution from a fossil fuel company is buying something in return, access or more. A political scientist might see it sometimes as a politician is extracting money from a company. Do you view it one way or the other?
Large donations from special interests are absolutely buying access, and I view it as corruption. The private campaign finance system right now is knowingly and directly responsible for the systemic corruption of public policymaking. And that's in both parties, especially. But we're interested in advancing independent accountability in the Democratic Party to have the best possible policy outcomes around things like our energy, habitable planet and energy future, and single-payer healthcare for everyone in the country and more. In your formulation, you described it as a little bit of, there's the studies show it's complicated, which it is. It's a complicated system of politics that we have. And money and politics reformers will look at it and point to and use the word corruption. And there's been great debate about whether or not to use that term. We use it. That's really a foundational part of our analysis. It might be more the case that a sort of everyday Democratic activist thinks, it's complicated. And if, for example, Senator Joe Biden is running for president, if he wants to take as much Comcast money as he wants, as long as he wins against Donald Trump in November of 2020, I bet that it's all going to be okay. And we've seen over and over abundant evidence of the shortcomings of Democratic policy and how that is not the case, and how big sugar, big telco, the weapons industry, and the for-profit healthcare industry, and the oil and gas industry, down the list, continue to control the policymaking process. They dominate what's legislatively possible in this country. And that's because of the access that they cede through campaign contributions, and then they expand 10 or 100-fold with lobbying that in turn then turns into millions and millions in lucrative fees or the revolving door that they can offer for this access to high-ranking staffers and former retired members of Congress who get really lucrative cash outs and millions of dollars in annual compensation if they go to lobby their former colleagues on behalf of these protected industries. The academic studies is a particular passion of mine because I love understanding the system as best it's studied, and I really respect independent research. And one great place that people can go is to go to opensecrets.org, which is the primary source for federal campaign contribution info, but find the resources and find the papers written from academic resources. There's strong evidence that many of these papers cited there do find statistical evidence of influence of policymaking and of bias that could be described fairly as corruption. So we stake out that turf. And what I hear in your question is, you know, well, is describing it as corruption the best tactical approach?
What I'm interested in is understanding sludge. And so what I'm coming to understand is there's a real political agenda that you bring to this investigation. And that agenda, you've sort of laid it out. It's fairly similar to where the left wing of the Democratic Party is, or Sanders, Warren, progressive activists. I wasn't sure where you would place yourself. It's journalism. You're trying to get to the truth. You're trying to use real data. You're trying to have a methodology. It's not fake news, right?
With Sludge, we publish investigative journalism, and we're part of this the general money and politics landscape of reporting. So we're part of a profession with standards and lots of checks.
But you do have a political agenda that you strongly believe in. And so, like, if you're hiring or commissioning stories, if you're deciding we're going to try to raise money to look into DNC members and expose them for something, you have a theory going in, right? Your theory is the elected members of the DNC are thwarting something progressive, right? They thwarted a debate on climate action. I'll say that
there's wide agreement that there, yeah, for in the case of the DNC member investigation project, there's wide agreement that there can be greater transparency and accountability, even among DNC members who are often pushing the leadership for it. And that, yes, I favor a Green New Deal. I favor Medicare for all. I favor net neutrality, and I favor criminal justice reform. And down the line, there's a number of issues that I have. And to see these advanced fairly in the process, I think that the interests that oppose them are multi-million dollar corporate interests that spend a lot on TV commercials around the presidential primary debates. They sponsor conferences with AstroTurf groups. They have marketing budgets in the millions, and that significantly affects the perception and the point of view of a typical Democratic primary voter. As a result, the party is dependent on large donor fundraising that precludes the boundaries that within the mini Overton window of the Democratic Party's leadership. It prevents them from a fair hearing on the potential benefits of a Green New Deal to congressional district. And instead of the discussion becoming how are all the ways that this can benefit our entire community, and not just the Democrats, but how is electric vehicle and light rail going to improve our congressional district, no matter, you know, how marginal it is, whether it's, you know, D+2 or, you know, R+5 or whatever, then instead of that process being raised in open, continual public meetings, the discussion becomes, oh, are we going to get those last 50,000 votes from a certain subset of voters to be able to keep the Democrat in office, and then maybe if everything else goes right, push this across the finish line. I'm interested in highlighting the better policy outcomes that come with greater independence in policymaking, that comes with small donor bases in elections, that comes with all the democracy reforms that are part of the HR1 democracy initiative that'll hopefully be advanced in the next U.S. Congress, since it's not going anywhere in this in Mitch McConnell's Senate, certainly. Goodness knows that. And I'm definitely interested in the kind of responsiveness that comes to the grassroots, because I have a personal allergy to arbitrary power and to sort of unearned authority. And I'm interested in helping more people and helping more Democratic Party members as well feel like the party is genuinely responsible to them so that they have some equity in it and that the participation is meaningful, which can unlock all these feedback loops of community self-improvement and improve lots of things in this country, like, for example, beginning to implement the Green New Deal.
How do you decide I'm going to investigate the Democratic Party versus I'm going to investigate the donors around Trump? How do you make that call if you've only three reporters and at the moment, you know, doing good work, but pretty limited resources?
So the Times, Post, ProPublica, and others are all, NPR, are all looking at the Kushners and Trump administration, the various Trump-world figures, and spending great investigative journalists are building incredible reputations for investigative journalism every week now. At Sludge, we publish extensively on Republicans, and we publish extensively on Mitch. One of our most popular articles ever was on Mitch McConnell's blocking of election security while taking checks from voting machine manufacturers. We try. And we publish extensively on the activities of hate groups, including many of them, corporate donations to white supremacists like Representative Steve King of Iowa, the Republican of Iowa. We advanced the discussion on that last year before the midterms by asking corporations if they supported Steve King's policy, the ones who had donated to him. So that was another way in which we advanced the national discussion on that. And we've tried to highlight hate and extremist groups who typically will support Republican candidates in their, you know, public Facebook posts and more. There's lots and lots on both sides. Of course, there's not just Democrats and Republicans. There's lots of independents and disaffected Americans making up the rest of it. The DNC is a place where we can have a great impact.
I'm kind of fascinated by your career. Where do you come from that you have this motivation to aim for transparency in government and try to move government in the direction that you're trying to? And then what have you learned along the way?
I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was a child of two public educators who cared a lot about the public education system. And I'm very grateful for the strong public education system in Milwaukee that helped set me on my way. I'll be excited for the Milwaukee 2020 convention, by the way, at the DNC. Shouts to any DNC members who are listening right now. I'm hoping I can get in my home city. I went to attended University of Brown University from 97 to 2001. Where I studied with MSNBC anchor Chris Hayes. He's a friend, and we studied philosophy together and became interested in systems for accountability and in different ways that communities formed meaning in politics as well. And so while Chris was reporting on labor and on progressive movements for outlets like The Nation in these times and others, I was building these open source web tools for civic engagement. And a lot of it comes down to trust and participation for me. I see them as really lacking. And I see a lot of the current contemporary discussion in the political landscape as rocketing back and forth in the absence of trust and participation. And after all, when voter turnout is only, you know, at our top in the federal elections, 57%, far, far below that of other developed countries, you've got to look at why, and then you've got to come to a fundamental analysis. I think that people who don't believe their vote can impact policies, change their lives, and that the system is closed off from them. And that's not just because of lawyers and legislation, it's because of powerful special interests. Then opening up these processes for greater participation in democracy, I think, yields better outcomes. And now the world is seeing a sense of urgency with that, with the now 11-year timeline to halve emissions, according to the IPCC. So the global climate emissions and the issue of the climate change, which I think is becoming more visible to everyone and that we're trying to highlight this week on Sludge, is a really pressing example of why more participation and trust in the process that we can change things and have a reason to, how that can, you know, help maintain a habitable planet and prevent the worst of catastrophes.
So if you were going to advise someone else who was also interested in how do I found an organization that makes a difference in this country as you've tried, what advice would you give that person?
One interesting way to do it I would recommend to people is to try to have 24 intro conversations with experienced practitioners in your field. Info pings, I mean, to a wide audience will help you map out a problem set and then determine a very specific focus, because in the area of, you know, technology for political participation, one recurring joke over and over again is like, wow, why don't we make a social network for politics? And every 4 years, someone else comes up with this idea and thinks that they're the ones to design it and that it's their specific design insight that's going to be put this one over the top. And sort of, unfortunately, it has never really caught on much at scale. There's not a parallel Facebook world where politics is more reality-based and rational and polite. So I think that you can avoid those problems by seeking lots and lots of input from experienced practitioners right away, and developing one minimum viable product right away to see whether people will say, they can't just say that's cool. They have to say, that's something I will use next month and I will send to 2,000 people. And then you have to go from there, because building that audience and that buy-in of not just like that's nice, but that's necessary is oftentimes what keeps a project going after the sort of initial rush and momentum has kicked in. And so there's lots of folks who, with sort of more, you know, revenue-driven, user-focused startups, who can talk about this process of generating equity with your audience. And that's why it's so important that we continue on this path of being supported by our small donors and independent readership. Because just like I'm asking the DNC to issue, you know, fossil fuel money as part of the No Fossil Fuel Money pledge, and to avoid ExxonMobil lobbyist bundles, so you forswear that $200,000. Instead, you can raise that and more from the grassroots. You can raise $400,000 and more from the grassroots if you pledge to keep their communities healthier and pledge to ban fracking and pledge to stop oil extraction in their off their waters is the goal.
That strikes me as a very good idea for like a business model for a newspaper, essentially, which what you're doing, but also a super hard one. So we talked a little bit about membership, but is your audience demanding more? Because a lot of times that audiences are not demanding exactly like investigative journalism. They're demanding, unfortunately, Kardashian crap.
We're hoping that we can unlock more by keeping our focus on our beat, that's money and politics, and by putting out original and, you know, meaningful work, like this partnership with The Guardian on the fossil fuel investments, or the deeper dive into this hedge fund work that had a lot of research behind it. And then we do try to play around with the marketing, in the sense of we try to make it catchy, and we try to, social media chatter is important for our lives, and I spend a lot of time on Twitter, and so I'm interested in, and do, you know, little tests to see what catches on, what hooks in describing an angle, you know, grab people's attention and generates more shares on social media. And then overall, to your question, is there can be a mass audience for lots of things, but we're looking to grow our core base into the thousands of supporters. Toward that goal, we don't always have to have, you know, articles that are on the front page of The Guardian, although that always helps. We need to make sure that our reporting connects with the audience that cares about the influence of money in politics, or that cares about the fossil fuel industry's influence over climate policy, or that cares about DNC accountability. And then making sure that you engage them is the goal. And with the independent membership-driven newsrooms, we have that good incentive to be responsive to our members.
So do you find yourself saying, hey, we really could use this subgroup as members, we should write an article that they will find attractive?
That's not a part of our process. That's not in our editorial flow. We do a lot of our coverage is driven by things like campaign finance deadlines, or by the sudden disclosure of someone being hired by a lobbying firm. We don't often go into the week with a set of stories planned. We're oftentimes seeking to be responsive in the news cycle to the money and politics topics that come up, while trying to advance sort of our core coverage areas of climate and coverage of extremist groups in the tech industry and more. We take advantage of what we see in our regular info scans. We've got a bunch of weird alert systems going, and our Twitter intake is voracious, and we're part of, you know, a dozen Slacks that's constantly popping off. Sometimes when we have a major investigation planned, sometimes it doesn't catch as much traffic as we anticipate. And other times, an article that we didn't expect to, you know, be our top article that month does catch a wave. And we're always learning from that, both about what the wider audience wants and especially then where our members and readers respond to us and talk back and ask follow-up questions. I would like to hear more from our readers. You know, I spend a lot of time in front of my laptop, like I am now, and I'm interested in hearing more questions about from readers about how the system works or about areas that they'd like to see investigated. And the best we can do is sort of sometimes to point them to other journalists who are working in those areas. We especially want to try to shout out local newsrooms and regional state newsrooms when we can, because they've got tremendous on-the-ground knowledge, and point people to the nonprofit investigative newsrooms in their area that we think are that we want to highlight their work. And so we try to work in partnership with them and produce data sets that allow for the follow-up stories to be reported with the local angles and help to try to build these beats as part of their people's diets so that maybe there's, you know, 5% less pop culture in the diet and 5% more. It's actually pretty interesting how this AstroTurf group sponsored an anti-net neutrality study. That's our goal.
It's a good call. You're a reporter. If you were asking questions about Sludge and David Moore, what would you want to be asked?
Well, I'm always into shouting out whose work is, there's lots of writers and lots of reporters who are doing really, really positive and influential work right now. I guess what comes to mind is who's been influential and who's doing, you know, work now that you think is just worthy of a shout out, right?
Yeah, who would that be?
The person who comes to mind first is my friend and colleague Maria Bustillos, the founder of Popula, writer based in California, and she's currently working as a public editor, like almost an ombudsperson for MSNBC, for the cable network. That's a project of CJR, assembled under their editor, Kyle Pope, and they're working on, you know, ombuds people for the Times, the Post, CNN as well. And I think that's a really important project in media criticism for the political landscape overall to be improved, to understand that, you know, right now, several million people are watching CNN and they are seeing a lot more horse race than they're seeing discussion of, you know, well, actually Medicare for All is pretty affordable and saves money, or, you know, the Green New Deal will, as far as we know, will create a lot of really important jobs while saving the planet. That's not the message that's coming across there. You know, at outlets like The American Prospect and The Intercept, there's lots of important work being done. And I especially follow Kate Aronoff's reporting on climate. The fossil fuel industry's influence is really forefront in that reporting. And so I read that regularly. There's great work happening at The Nation as well on investigating corporate influence. The Nation has been a mainstay in showing the influence of lobbying on the policymaking process. And if I could encourage listeners to pick up Ryan Grimm's book, We've Got People, is imperative for understanding how the Democratic Party managed to lose so many state elective seats over the Obama administration and why the 2016 election turned out the disastrous way it did.
David, it's been really an honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Nathaniel. And at readsludge.com, you can sign up to get our free email newsletter. It's the 20th of September today, and our crowdfunder runs for 2 more weeks. After that, we'll be interested in get in touch with me to discuss any gifts to support our investigative journalism, but also just to learn about the membership program and when we send online event hangouts to our members. But you can get all of our scoops over email every week. Our newsletter just went out.
That was David Moore with Sludge. He's at readsludge.com. I'm interested to follow Sludge and see what they cover and say. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.